Wir kommen zu unserem zweiten Redner, Pat Mooney, ursprünglich Entwicklungshelfer aus Kanada. Er erforscht seit Jahrzehnten die sozioökonomischen Einflüsse moderner Technologien auf tradierte ländliche Gemeinschaften und Kulturen sowie Natur und Umwelt. Seit 2001 ist er leitender Geschäftsführer der Etc. Group, nämlich der Action Group on Erosion, Technology and Concentration, eine gemeinnützige zivilgesellschaftliche Organisation zur Bewahrung und Förderung der kulturellen und ökologischen Vielfalt sowie der Menschenrechte. Sie setzt sich kritisch mit den Risiken und Folgen moderner Technologien wie der Gentechnologie oder der Nanotechnologie auseinander. In den letzten Jahren hat sich das Engagement von Pat Mooney und der Etc. Group auch auf die Risiken des Geoengineering ausgedehnt, technische Eingriffe in geochemische oder biogeochemische Kreisläufe, mit denen der Klimawandel oder die Übersäuerung der Meere aufgehalten werden sollen. In seinem neuen Buch Next Bang beschreibt er einige dieser wahnwitzigen Pläne. Dear Mr. Mooney, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and I don't think I'm ever going to follow Hans Peter again. It's always shocking and stimulating. And the one thing I have to say is that after hearing him speak, he's kind of made the task that I thought I had, which was in talking about some new technologies, much, much easier. Because in one swell swoop, he kind of eliminated all the with atoms. I was going to talk about nanotechnology and synthetic biology, but they're kind of gone now with that. And then I was going to try to talk about political strategies around new technologies and Hans Peter's discussion of the improbability of him cleaning up his desk by the weekend. I began to think about the improbability of me cleaning up my act by the weekend, and not a chance. So I'm left struggling now to figure out what I can talk to you about. He really gives a perspective on these issues, which I think is invaluable, if disturbing. But it also makes it easier for me to summarize, perhaps also. When I started to be involved in social issues in the 1960s as a teenager, the really cutting edge sort of debate in society that I was familiar with was the debate over something called liberation theology. It was a Latin American concept, particularly a Brazilian or Chilean concept, that from a religious perspective initially, which I did not share because I'm not a religious person, but still an interesting concept on how to view humanity, our relationship with each other, and this concept of liberation as the theology. It made sense to me, and I found it a stimulating debate as a student or as a teenager, at least in the 1960s. We seem to have moved away from that somehow. I haven't heard much conversations like that in decades. Now, instead of liberation theology, we seem to have moved to liberation technology. Somehow now, we don't have to actually work together cooperatively to establish solutions together to social problems. What we've got to do is sit back and let technology solve the problems for us. For every problem, there's a technological fix. If we're worried about world hunger and 1 billion hungry people on the planet, don't worry, because we have biotechnology to take care of that for us. If we're worried about an energy crisis and we're not sure that and concerned about peak oil, don't worry, we have synthetic biology that will step in, and we'll have new forms of biofuels that will gobble up cellulosic fiber and new forms of algae that will get us through our energy problems, and we can all keep on consuming happily. If we're concerned about raw materials, phosphates or other limitations in supplies of raw materials and the costs of getting those raw materials, don't worry. Nanotechnology will step in. with materials that are 100 times lighter than or stronger than steel and 6 times lighter than steel, and so and making the periodic table in fact a multiple of itself so that we can use almost any raw material to do almost anything. So we don't need to be concerned about limitations there. If we're concerned about our planet, about the survival of our planet in terms of climate change and the terrible risks of the decades ahead with climate change, don't worry, be happy. We really are okay. We have the ability to geoengineer the planet. After all, the proof of principle, the scientific proof of principle that we can geoengineer the planet is well established. We did it. We're in the situation in the first place. Industrial society, the industrial revolutions, have geoengineered the planet into its current crisis. So, of course, we can relax because we know we can then, as human beings, geoengineer ourselves out of the crisis again. Well, maybe, but I doubt it. But the solutions, then, are such that politicians don't actually have to be political anymore. Policymakers don't actually have to make policy anymore. All we have to do is sit back and wait for that technological fix to come. We don't have to worry about our lifestyles. We don't have to worry about our economy being adjusted in some way. There will be a solution. We simply need to put more money into new technologies, more research, more investment, and have more faith in a newer kind of God that will take care of these things somehow in some scientific laboratory somewhere. That's obviously for me a disturbing thought and not one that I believe. It's one that I think we need to be challenging, though, as we especially look at the world we're in terms of climate change, but as much in terms of hunger and poverty. And it's strange how over the last few years, and I'm in no way a climate change denier, I think it is a terrible threat to our survival. But at the same time, we somehow have managed to kind of forget about those other little things like hunger and poverty. They've kind of been subordinated to how do we get ourselves through the climate change situation. And I certainly would argue in the first place that if we're going to survive climate change, we can only do it if we bear in mind in the first instance and work and listen to and follow the advice of those who are the most marginalized in our planet, who will show us the way through and show us the way that we can equitably and honorably get from where we are now to a place which is safe for all of us as human beings. Any other way is dishonest and dangerous. But let's look at what some of these proposals are, and I'll try to very briefly go through a couple of them because, as Hans-Peter said, they don't really exist. The first one I'll discuss as briefly is nanotechnology, which is probably the one that's most familiar to people. And it seems strange now because 10 years ago, when we first began working on nanotechnology as an issue, no one believed it was even possible or could exist. And the term wasn't even well known. But it is there. It's moving very rapidly, and yet it's an area where, and I will argue this consistently in all of the cases I'd like to discuss, it's an area where there's been a level of scientific hubris which is terrifying and incredibly stupid. And there's been a level of policy ignorance which is completely unacceptable by our policymakers. So that we have technologies coming forward now at an incredibly rapid pace, not just one at a time, not single file, but together, collectively, challenging our logic and our thinking and our time, and we have no time to think about them, no time to think of their implications. Nanotechnology is one of those examples. Over the last 10 years, industrialized governments, and not just industrialized governments, in fact, a few others as well, in the last 10 years, governments have spent in public basic research $50 billion in developing nanotechnology. This year alone, $10 billion will be spent in the public sector on basic research in nanotechnology. We have several thousand products now in the marketplace. The Canadian government, my government, a few months ago estimated there are about 1,600 products, but they went on to say that probably 90% of the products that are using nanotechnology are unknown, because no one's talking about it, no one's aware of what they are. It's a fascinating area, and I think for Hans-Peter, even if they don't exist, as such, it's still, and I know he understands this much better than that, even though the potential of nanotechnology is fascinating. The potential risk and effects of nanotechnology are fascinating. The possibility for industry is, of course, that as you move down from the classical scales into the nanoscale, you move into quantum effects. As you move there from maybe 300 nanometers in size, and a nanometer is 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter, as you move down to that size, you find yourself suddenly seeing everything change. Suddenly, the aluminum oxide that's used by dentists to repair your teeth becomes something which can explode. Suddenly, the gold on your wedding ring turns into, at a certain scale, something which can be a catalyst for chemical reactions. Everything, as we move down, keeps on changing as well. The materials that we're familiar with, that we know work in certain ways in the classical level, at the macro level, keep on transforming themselves as they go down and down and down in terms of their response to magnetism, their response to their light, their response to temperature, pressure, and so on, keep on adjusting. This makes nanoscale materials incredibly attractive to industry because it's like a multiplier effect on the periodic table itself. Instead of having just a handful of toys to play with in terms of manufacturing the world's resources, materials, we suddenly have perhaps hundreds of materials that work in such different ways that we could ever imagine. And also, of course, as you move down in size, you move into a slightly other worrisome area, which is, of course, once you get to a certain scale, your immune system doesn't even know those nanoparticles are there. They can't detect them. And so you can have nanoparticles that are used today in Germany as cosmetics or as foods or as sunscreens or in clothing, which if they slip through into your body, through your skin, can slip into your organs, can possibly pass the blood-brain barrier, can possibly go through the placenta, and again, your immune system won't even be aware of it. And yet there is simply no regulation over 10 years and $50 billion of investment in the public sector. There is simply no understanding of regulation around nanotechnology. And even though there are thousands of products in the marketplace that we're using daily, there is no sense of whether this material is safe or is not. And I don't know the answer to that. I just know that those who are supposed to know haven't even investigated the issue closely. And yet we're being told that, don't worry, this is going to be a solution to raw material supply. This also could be a major solution to our energy issues and to our food issues. It goes on and on. If you notice, by the way, over the decades, for those of us who have been around for a few decades, about once a decade or so, every 15, 20 years at the latest, we've seemed to get a new technology that is going to solve all our problems. For those who were around in the 1950s, remember how atomic energy solved all our problems? All done, all taken care of. Everything was going to be taken care of through atomic power. Didn't seem to quite happen. Then we were going to have the chemical age was going to solve all our problems. And now, as we were heard at the beginning, there's 70,000 chemicals a day being pushed into the environment. We have no idea how they work, especially how they work in compound and together. But that was going to solve all of our food and hunger problems, all of our energy problems again. And then in the 1990s, the solution to all of our problems was going to be biotechnology, good old-fashioned biotechnology. It seems so long ago. And that was going to take care of everything. But of course, that hasn't either. We're still being told the promises that will happen, that someday these will do these things. And when I first heard about biotechnology, there were 500 million hungry people on the planet. And in fact, they wrote about how, in the publications in the industry, were feeding the 500 million. And today, we have 1 billion hungry people on the planet, and we're still being told, don't worry, biotechnology will solve the problem. So nanotechnology offers us some possibilities, but amazingly, here it is in the marketplace, $50 billion spent and no regulations, and no clarity even on what it is. We can't even get an agreement among governments around the world or among scientists as to how to measure nanotechnology particles. There are many ways to do it, no one ever agrees. Depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on, you can have a debate about whether this is a nanomaterial or not. Because some people say it's at 100 nanometers and below, others say it's 300 nanometers and below, or something like that. You can actually take things like carbon nanotubes, which are the poster child of the technology, and depending on which lab you are in, whether you are in Brussels or in Berlin or in Boston, how you measure that material and how you interpret how it functions will depend upon which lab it is, no matter how hard you try to be precise about the materials. And yet, we're eating them. And this is going to be a solution for us. In the area of synthetic biology, the same thing, that synthetic biology is really nanobiotechnology. It's really, again, because after all, DNA is at the nanoscale. It is that instead of with old-fashioned biotech, where you move a gene from one species to another, with synthetic biology, you go beyond that. You actually write your own books. You don't move a, it's not like moving a letter from one place to another. It's, you're doing the whole thing over again. You're actually building your own DNA from the bottom up. And as we've learned, even just this year, as governments try to understand what the implications of synthetic biology might be, we're learning that it's possible to trick the cell into reading DNA in different ways. So instead of simply reading in groups of codons as before, suddenly it's possible to confuse the cell so that instead of making 20 different amino acids, it can make up to 276 different amino acids, which means that you can have proteins and build life forms that we can't even imagine. Or in May of this year, when Craig Venter, the leading scientist in this field, was able to announce in the scientific press and the world media, in May of this year, he announced that his company, Synthetic Genomics, for the first time ever in human history, was able to take simple non-living atomic materials and turn them into living, replicating, a living, replicating life form, a life form the planet has never seen before, self-replicating. So that for the first time ever in human history, God has competition. There's now another way to build things. And yet again, the policymakers are saying, don't worry, be happy, because this will be the solution to the energy crisis. This will be the way that we stop the competition over biomass between fuels and food. This will be the way that we can harness more of the solar power than ever before, so it's going to be fine. But people don't even know what's happening. It could have some great benefits, as could nanotechnology, but if we're not even aware of it, if we're not thinking about what the implications might be. I was at a meeting of the scientific subcommittee of the Biodiversity Convention a couple of years ago when the committee met in Rome, and we invited one of the leading proponents and top scientists at MIT in synthetic biology, Drew Endy. We invited Drew to come with us to Rome to meet with governments and the scientists in the governments to talk about synthetic biology and its implications for biological diversity. And Drew Endy said, in the meeting with governments, said, well, I'm sorry if you lose biological diversity, but don't worry, because we can build it for you. We thought we'd need to have police escorts to get him out of the building safely. And he was only half joking, because as he can show, it's possible today to create more unnatural biological diversity in a test tube than it is to create natural to maintain natural biodiversity in the Amazon, with the ways in which DNA can now be constructed. Again, these technologies are developing and they're being presented to us as solutions, but again, there's no capacity in the part of governments to understand them or even to do the basic homework around what the positives and the negatives might possibly be. But the greatest one we have of all, the greatest concern I'd like to express, because in both synthetic biology and nanotechnology materialize in this other discussion as well, is that of geoengineering. This idea that we can geoengineer the planet back to a safer place than is moving today with climate change. It can sound brilliantly logical. In fact, there's a meeting taking place in Kiel tomorrow, here in Germany, where academics and governments or government officials are meeting to talk about how could we establish a governance structure under which we can geoengineer the planet. How could that be done? There's working groups around the world actually debating this issue. There's groups in Heidelberg. There's groups in the major discussions taking place between the United Kingdom and the United States. We have the UK Royal Society together with the National Academy of Sciences in the United States meeting at the beginning of November to talk about exactly how it is they could establish governance models that will give them permission to geoengineer the planet? And what kinds of protocols are needed for the testing, the field testing of geoengineering experimentation? And the experimentation is fascinating stuff because it really cuts into two areas of development. One side says that we can geoengineer the surface of the oceans. We can create nutrient bases where the oceans are sterile, which will create a phytoplankton bloom, which will absorb carbon dioxide, possibly other greenhouse gases, which will then sink to the bottom of the ocean, and we can again carry on consuming because we've taken care of greenhouse gases. I'm simplifying, obviously. On the other side, the much more popular idea now is that what we can do is we can do something called solar radiation management. That means that we can perhaps blast sulfates into the stratosphere, a bit like an artificial volcano. Blast them high enough into the stratosphere so that at the nanoparticle scale, they'll drift there for about 2 years on average, and we can block sunlight enough to at least buy time, maybe 20 or 30 years of time in the end, that will let us, that will keep the temperatures low enough so we can look for other solutions. These ideas are being presented and debated in the U.S. Congress, in the U.K. Parliament, and in my government in Canada. They're being debated as reasonable, logical, scientific initiatives that need to be explored, the plan B of what happens if we don't have a solution over Kyoto. At the Kyoto meetings that took place in Copenhagen, geoengineers, in fact, got exactly what they wanted. And the last day, in fact, one of the last meetings that were attended by my folks in the Et Cetera group was a meeting of the Royal Society working on geoengineering. The meeting was actually celebratory. It was, we got what we wanted here because Copenhagen proved itself as a failure. It proved that governments cannot establish at a multilateral level an agreement on how to handle carbon emissions. Therefore, they have to go to us. They have to go to a plan B, and we are the plan B to geoengineer the planet. And they've carried on with that assumption ever since then, with support from the White House and other places saying this is really, we have no choice. Reasonable human beings must say to each other, we can't get, governments will not do it, therefore the scientific community and industry together will have to work on this and get the job done. We even have conversations saying that we need a new kind of coalition of the willing, of that handful of governments that have the courage to come together and say, okay, the world won't do it for itself, we will have to geoengineer the planet on behalf of the world. We have to be the brave ones to make these decisions for everybody else. I find that absolutely terrifying, because at one level, again, it seems reasonable. Why shouldn't science be allowed to explore? Why shouldn't there be investigations? Why can't we experiment? Shouldn't we be allowed to do that? The problem is that the scientists themselves, in looking at issues like solar radiation management, the stratospheric spreads or the ocean sprays and so on, are all saying we need to work at a big scale. We can't do this at a small scale and know what the impact's going to be. We have to talk about 50,000 square kilometers of ocean surface. We have to talk about blotting out the sun, basically, or at least dulling the sun, not blotting it out, to lower temperatures over a continent to be able to understand what the effects will be. In other words, we've really got to change the climate in order to see if we can change the climate safely. And that's unacceptably dangerous. Fundamentally, what it comes down to, I think, is pretty basic. It is that can we, and just if each of you just think about this, can we actually believe, even for a moment, that the governments that have denied climate change for decades, that the governments who've refused to do what they have to do to even talk about climate change with their public, that the governments who can't reach any kind of level of agreement in Copenhagen, that the governments who don't even have the courage to tell their populations to slow down on the autobahn, that those governments actually would have either the integrity or the intelligence to control the planet's systems, to have their hand on the thermostat of the planet and do it in any way which could conceivably bear in mind the interests of marginalized peoples around the world. I can't think it's possible. I can't imagine that could be done. We don't have that kind of politician. We don't have that kind of policymaker. It doesn't take place. Whatever they will do as a brave new coalition of the willing on behalf of the rest of us to get themselves out of the embarrassment of losing an election and telling their public what's really true about climate change, whatever they do will not work well. At the end of the day, as we look at this suite of new technologies as they come forward, fascinating, every one of them, intriguing, and some of them perhaps in some ways extremely useful, as we see them coming forward, I think we need to remember a couple of things. One of them is, and I hear this always from scientists, is, well, you know, they say they can do this with nanotechnology, or they think they can do something else with synthetic biology, but it won't really work that way. Nature is far more complex than they realize. Nature will kick back. Nature will show them that they're wrong about this, or they're only got a little, or they're only partly right. And of course, that's true. Nature will show that. That doesn't mean that devastation and destruction don't happen anyway. It doesn't mean that actually those who propose these things don't still make a profit from it. Because the reality is, and biotechnology I think is one of the best proofs of this in agriculture, the reality is you can have a really sloppy technology. Sometimes really bad science even behind the sloppy technology, and you can still make money. All you have to do is convince everybody else that this is the only way to go. All you've got to do is get the government regulators out of the way. All you've got to do is get the intellectual property protection that you require, and then you can carry on. That's all. Who cares if you don't do it well? You still will make money. The second lesson, I think, is a lesson from history, which is if we look back at the impacts of major new technologies that they've been introduced into societies over the last couple of hundred years, is that every new technology, regardless of how it has ended up or how useful we might find it today, every new technology that's been introduced into a society which is not itself a just and honorable society, that technology will exacerbate the gap between the rich and the marginalized. Not only to the point where the rich get richer, but the marginalized will get poorer. I think that's a clear message of history. And with these new technologies coming forward today in these troubled times, still even more likely. Somehow, new technologies have a wonderful way of concentrating power. And I want to give you quick examples of how that's happening in the case of synthetic biology, nanotechnology, and even in the broader fields of geoengineering, really. In the case of nanotechnology, one of the most shocking aspects of the technology is not its safety. So I actually think those problems can be solved. The problem is, the most shocking part is, how is it going to be owned? Who's going to control it? Who gets to decide how this powerful technology will be used? Patents have already been granted, are in place around the world, which allow, for example, for any use of 33 different elements in the periodic table at the nanoscale if they're used to construct wires, which is almost everything used in nanotechnology. So with one single patent, about what, at the least half or 40% of the functioning elements in the periodic table have been monopolized at the nanoscale. One single patent. Patents have been granted in nanotechnology, which they say are for the pharmaceutical industry. And then they go on to say it could be used in electrical machinery, could be used in the aerospace industry, could be used in foods and beverages and textiles and explosives, in informatics technologies, and on and on and on. In other words, a single patent that cuts across the entire economy in every sector of industrial production, a single patent, and that's already granted. We find in the area of synthetic biology, patents are being granted now, which again control processes of making life. But most worrisome of all, in terms of the issues that I've dealt with most of my life, problems related to world hunger, most worrisome is that we now have a group of six companies who are telling us that, don't worry, they will develop climate-ready crops using synthetic biology. And all they need to have is permission to have patents on large chunks of DNA. And the large chunks of DNA they're talking about, strangely enough, show up in every single crop. So the patent claim by a company like BASF or Bayer or Monsanto or Syngenta or DuPont or Dow, those are the companies, the patent claims apply to all species of all agricultural species. All of them. And any use of that DNA in any of those species. So in other words, they're controlling the food supply. There are 262 such patents, families right now, involving over 1,600 patents around the world. And that's the control of our future. I think we've got to go back to liberation theology. I don't think liberation technology is a solution for us. Technologies have a role to play, but only in a social context. We've forgotten that context. We need politicians that make decisions and policymakers that are prepared to recommend policies. In a society, civil society, that is watchful and active and holds them to account. Thank you very much.